The world's a messy place. Just have a look at the map. Why are some countries so big, others so small? For that matter, why do we have so many of them? Do you know, there were 74 countries in 1945. Now there's nearly 200. It's a dog's breakfast, and economists, the neat freaks of the social sciences world, find this particularly troubling. The size of nations is our topic today on Right Side Economics with Professor Andrew Lee from the Australian National University. Hello, Andrew.
Good morning, Richard.
Why have we had this sort of massive inflation in the number of countries since 1945?
Well, Richard, a terrific book by Alberto Alessino and Enrico Spolaeore argues that there's two big factors that determine the size of a country. One is economics, which drives you towards bigger countries because you get economies of scale, more of us to pay for the embassies, for the Reserve Bank, for the army, and a bigger internal market to buy and sell goods. And then there's a set of political factors that drive you towards smaller countries. So you want a smaller country because it's pretty hard to manage a big, diverse country with lots of different preferences, rich and poor, people speaking different languages, different ethnic groups. All of that becomes harder and harder to manage as countries get big. So they say that's the way to think about the trade-off in country size. And then we've had these massive drivers over the last 50 years, democratisation and free trade, that have made it easier to cut it as a little country in the world.
So the end of the great empires, colonisation going, the USSR breaking up and growth of free trade, they're the key things. When you look at a map, the size and the population of the different countries varies enormously. Is there, given what you've just said about the size of nations, that book, is there a kind of Goldilocks size, not too big, not too small, from the economic point of view?
Well, there is. It's the size that trades off the economics and the politics. The thing is that constantly the world is constantly changing, and so that optimal size was pretty big at the end of World War II. Trade barriers were really high, and so what mattered was whether you had a decent size internal market. We also had more dictators around, and dictators can do things that democratic governments can't do. They can repress minority groups, and so dictators from the Roman Empire to the rulers of the Soviet Union have devoted a lot of energy to common languages and really crowding out those minority groups which might try and split away. As soon as a country democratizes, then the minority groups have a much greater incentive to spin off.
Okay, well let's have a current example of what might be a country. Greenland wants to split off from Denmark. It's the size of WA, but it only has, I think, just fewer than 60,000 people. Is that viable as a country?
Well, it usedn't to be, but Greenland is now increasingly becoming viable because of the growth of the European Union and also its ability to trade with other countries. So average tariff barriers in the world were more like 20 or 30% a couple of decades ago. Now they're more like 5% around the world. And that's made it a lot easier for a place like Greenland to say, well, you know, we're 60,000 mostly Inuit people. We're ruled by Denmark, and we actually don't have that much in common with Denmark. So in the middle of this year, they've taken a big step towards autonomy, and you know, my guess is within a couple of decades, they may well choose to fully go it on their own.
What about a country that already exists, East Timor? Small country, somewhere between 800,000 and perhaps just over a million people. There's a bit of blurriness about the population. It's a very young population, has to import food, but has these oil and gas reserves. Viable?
Well, so East Timor came into being largely because of the change in democratisation. Had Indonesia not democratised, it would have been possible for successive Indonesian dictators to continue keeping a lid on the ethnic differences within Indonesia. As soon as democracy came about in Indonesia, it became impossible to hang on to Timor. And the East Timorese themselves, I think, recognised that trade barriers were now low enough that it was possible to make their way in the world. If no one else wants to trade with you, it's really, really tough being a small country. But if other countries are willing to buy and sell your goods, then it becomes more possible. East Timor is never going to be super rich, but it's certainly got better prospects now than it would have had in the 1960s.
All right. Well, what about the other end of the scale, Andrew? The really big countries, so China or the US. Can you get too big?
Well, you certainly can, Richard. And I think one of the things that has happened with the United States is its huge market has been terrific for it in an economic sense. The US basically doesn't need to trade with the rest of us. It's nice that it does. But with 300 million people in the internal market, you can do a lot within those borders. But the US is also an incredibly diverse country. It's got these huge gaps between rich and poor, left and right, African-Americans and Hispanics and white Americans. That's really hard politically to hold together. So, you know, you see these successive pressures and people in Texas talking about seceding and so on, which are a testament to the fact it's really tough to keep a country that big together. Likewise for China. I think China can be kept together by dictators who are able to keep down all of these little ethnic minority groups. But my guess is that when China democratizes, it'll become impossible to hold the place together. They'll lose some of those economic benefits that they get from being a single country. But outlying regions will say, you know, we'd rather make it in our own in a free trade world.
On Life Matters today, it's Rightside Economics. We do it every couple of weeks with Professor Andrew Lee from the Australian National University. Today we're talking about countries, about the size of countries, their populations, and how big they can be or how little they can get away with being. If you think about Africa, Andrew, this seems to be the way that you divide a continent in the most spectacularly bad way possible, because you've got quite a lot of countries, many of them are small, many of them are poor.
So observers have noticed a couple of things about Africa. Firstly, they've noticed the suspiciously straight lines.
Yes.
44% of African boundaries are straight lines of some form. And you wouldn't think that a straight line is typically the line that naturally divides two sort of different groups. So a lot of the boundaries have been imposed by outsiders. And then development economists have said, well, maybe Africa has too many countries. Maybe it would be better off if it had a lot more consolidation, given that African countries tend to have high trade barriers, smush a few of them together and you end up with places which might be viable economic units. The trouble with that is that your economic gains come at a political cost. You may potentially put together ethnic, racial, religious groups which are incompatible and which just simply can't agree on how to run a schooling system, what sort of army to have, how to put together a parliament. So Africa, I think after...
We've already got states where that happens in Africa, of course.
Indeed. And so the Alassane Espolo-Ari argument on Africa, which I've now come to believe, is that Africa doesn't have too many countries, but it may have the boundaries drawn in the wrong places. And the way in which to see boundaries better drawn is to encourage African countries to successively lower not only their regular trade barriers, but also just to make it easier to do business with one another. And that then means you don't have to worry from an economic point of view about the size of the countries, and you can just optimise on politics and get the politics right.
Because what you can't do, probably, is negotiate to have the physical boundaries redrawn. That's just politically not going to be possible, is it?
We see it from time to time, but it's certainly tough to do these kinds of land swaps. Even if you wanted to keep the total area on both sides of the boundary constant, you're moving villages, and that's really hard to do. Partly that's because leaders set about building a national ethos. So you draw an arbitrary boundary. The villages on either side of those were the same to begin with, but 50 years on, a village on one side really believes in one national ethos, and a village on the other side passionately believes in another national ethos. So it's hard to redraw.
Well, let's talk about another couple of countries with their own national ethoses, and that's Australia and New Zealand. And every now and again, about once a decade or so, the idea of an economic merger with New Zealand comes up. Is there a good economic case for this?
I think there's certainly a strong economic case, which is that firstly we could gain by being a single market. It's true we already have free trade between New Zealand and Australia, but we know that two countries, even where there's free trade, don't do as much commerce as two states. And so it's certainly the case for the US and Canada that even Canadian provinces right on the border of say, Michigan, don't trade as much as they do with outlying Canadian provinces. And I'm sure that's true of Australia and New Zealand. So we'd get these economic gains, but we'd also have political costs. And I think that's the thing that we don't spend too much time talking about when we discuss possible mergers. The issues that arise with Maori New Zealanders are quite different from the issues that arise with Indigenous Australians. New Zealanders have a different set of political preferences. There's different economic levels, and so we'd be widening the degree of inequality in the merged entity, and that would create its own sort of political tensions. And so all of those things, I think, probably drive you towards thinking, well, maybe we've gotten it right at the moment, and maybe the economic gain just wouldn't be worth the political pain.
I spent a lot of my 20s living in New Zealand, and I have to say, I cannot imagine it ever happening. The political differences, the histories of the countries are just too different. The differences are too profound.
Certainly the mergers that the world has seen in the last 50 years are few and far between. So you can point, for example, to Germany. But really, Germany, the German people wanted to merge, stay together after World War II. And so that's sort of an artificial, a country that was artificially held apart for a long amount of time, finally allowed to come back together. Apart from that, there's very few mergers. The whole story of the last half century has been countries splitting apart as democratisation and free trade has made it easier.
Now, what about a part of a country leaving another country? So in Australia, Western Australia, the secession movement there goes up and down in popularity. Part of the state's identity is being different from everybody else. It's got tons and tons of resources. Could it be done?
Well, if you thought that secessionist pressures within Australia were going to continue to abate, I think you're probably wrong. The secessionist pressures around the world have continued to grow. We see secessionist pressures growing a lot within, say, Spain, within Catalonia, within the UK, the sort of Scottish and Welsh movements to split off. The Quebecois are constantly pressuring to split off from Canada. And likewise, I think we should expect the Western Australians and maybe the Queenslanders to continue talking about this. Much easier now than 30 or 40 years ago to imagine how the country of Western Australia could make its way in the world alone.
Wouldn't it cost a fortune? It cost a fortune, though, wouldn't it?
Well, so the public good stuff is still there. They still have to have all their own, worry about their embassies, their currency, their army, and so on. But in terms of the huge cost of splitting off on your own, is that no one wants to do commerce with you, and so you suddenly have to start your own industry and a bunch of things that you're not very good at. You have to start building cars, for example, rather than importing them from people that make cars better than you do. So now it's much easier to imagine that the cost of Western Australian independence has fallen substantially and will continue to fall.
All right, Andrew. That is where we'll leave it, I think, for now. Andrew Lee is a Professor of Economics at the Australian National University, and you hear him every couple of weeks when we do Right Side Economics here on ABC Radio National's Life Matters.